Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Threats of further unrest planned by anti-immigration demonstrators across England have failed to materialise overnight. More than 6,000 officers had been mobilised in anticipation. Instead, thousands of anti-racism campaigners gathered in cities and towns for peaceful counter-protests. But there are fears of more unrest over the weekend. Scotland's First Minister, John Swinney, said that he has deep concerns about escalating violence across the UK.
Everybody's got a right to feel safe in Scotland. I can't stop bad actors stirring things up in our society, but what I can do is work to make sure that we have the resources and the plans in place to make sure everybody can be kept safe.
Three Taylor Swift concerts in Vienna have been cancelled after two men were arrested over planning an Islamist attack. The Austrian Chancellor said a tragedy had been averted. And in the Paris Olympics, Team GB is currently fifth place in the medals table after winning three more yesterday. Today, double Olympic champion in Taekwondo Jade Jones is in action. That's the latest from Radio News Hub. I'm Stephen Davis.
When you need a number fast, the only number you need is 118212.
Miss Maureen, the telephone detective, at your service.
Maureen! 118212.
Calls cost £2.50 per call, plus 75p a minute with a minimum 1 minute charge, plus your phone company's access charge.
Coming up, owning it with Iola.
And she's off! The corner shop is in sight, the National Lottery sign is there, and she's heading right for it! Look at Rebecca. She's making a real difference just by playing the National Lottery. Her numbers help fund Team GB and Paralympics GB athletes, powering their journey to Paris, one ticket at a time. Oh, just look at her go! Unbelievable stuff! Changing lives like it's a walk to the shops.
The National Lottery, changing lives every day. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Owning it with Iola.
Morning, 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 beautiful peeps. I hope you are well and blessed in all ways. Welcome to Owning It with your girl, Iola. We are here live at the Africa Center, here to bring you some joy. I am in the studio with my girl, Akwia Ofosahini. Welcome, Akwia.
Thank you, thank you. So excited to be here once again.
Yes, yes, yes. So last week we were talking about Blackxit. So Blackxit is a social movement that encourages repatriation of the African diaspora, whether you're from America or the UK or wherever you're from, to repatriate back to your country of origin. So Akwia and I have spent a protracted period. Was it 5 months you were there?
Yep.
5 months in Ghana. I spent 4 months in Ghana. Such an honour, such a privilege, such an experience. And last week we were talking about our experiences from a cultural exchange position of privilege, with us as the repatriates being the subject and, you know, just the kind of treatment that you receive and the disparities and the lessons that we learn. One of them being confidence, which I found really, really intriguing insofar as, you know, having enhanced confidence as a woman, particularly when in Ghana. You know, big up to the Ghanaian businesswomen. Big up to Fulera, our sister Fulera, doing her thing out there and throughout the world, actually, doing some really big things with her products and her distribution and so many more women. And it's just, you know, there's less of a class differentiation, but more so we found that success is based on confidence. So yeah, you can, you know, there's some things to be said about being back home, being around your people and having the spirit of conviction to say, yeah, I am this, I am fantastic, I am successful, and, you know, seizing the opportunities to become just that. So this week we are looking at it from a slightly different perspective, somewhat going back in what I call a Sankofa state of mind. If you don't know what Sankofa is, or Sankofa, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right.
You are.
I am. Okay, yeah. Great. That's a good start. Akwia, just remind people if they don't know, or people that don't know, what Sankofa actually is.
Yeah. So Sankofa is a, the first thing is that it's a symbol, and it's a symbol that represents a saying, which also represents a state of mind. And it literally means there is nothing wrong in going back to fetch it. And it is a whole philosophy that actually says you cannot go forward in full confidence and drive unless you know your past, you know your history. The answers we seek are behind us. And so that's the Sankofa, go back and fetch it.
Yes, yeah. I absolutely love that. It's so important to learn from your history, whether it's traditions, cultures, customs, just way of living, being, in order to move forward.
Yeah.
And there's two symbols, isn't there? There's a heart-shaped symbol there. So these are Adinkra symbols from the Asante.
Tribe people.
Yeah, so, and then there's the other one, which is, I guess, a little bit more symbolic of the actual translation, which is a bird, and his head is turned back, and he has an egg in his mouth, and he's, you know, fetching that in order to move forward.
Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely love it. That is one of my favourite, if not my favourite, Adinkra symbol. So,
totally.
In the spirit of Sankofa, Sankofa state of mind, as I say, we are discussing our experiences. So I wanted to talk about it from the perspective of, and we kind of touched on it last week, what I'm coining social reciprocity, insofar as, you know, diasporans are coming in their droves, you know, especially from America. There's a lot of like British Caribbean people as well, who are buying land, you know, building businesses, as I mentioned last week. And there's so few red tape that it makes it easier for you to seize opportunities where you see it and actually build something from scratch and with a lot less money than you would, you know,
imagine
that it would take, especially if you're coming from the UK or the States. It takes a lot less, and you know, just maximizing the opportunity. And one thing I wanted to say, I saw this video going around, I think it's from TikTok, some of you may have seen it, with this white guy, American white guy, talking about, you know, people kind of often look at, you know, living in Africa, wherever that may be, as something that's, you know, less favorable. But those of us who know, know. And he basically outlines all the benefits of living in a place like Ghana, for example, where you pay for your rent upfront a year or 2 years in advance. You don't have that hanging over your head.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that you can buy your land and the fact that you can just have a better quality of life. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what it's all about, really. I mean, you want to have more time, freedom. Mm-hmm. So for me, you know, having experience living there, I was doing some work whilst I was there remotely. So that was, you know, obviously a privilege in and of itself. Yeah. And we know so many people are actually doing that, working online, working remotely, working from home. And so they're able to afford to be able to, you know, live in different countries without the massive overheads, you know. So, yeah, in terms of social reciprocity, you know, it's really about what can we do as diasporans to ensure that we are somehow ensuring that the local indigenous people aren't missing out. Mm. So that could look like, obviously, the easiest one is employing locally. Employing locals, and more often than not, I think people are doing that anyway because often, you know, they're
it's
cheaper labor. Yeah. But also just, you know, empowering them and encouraging them and upskilling them more importantly so that they can take something away. So you're bringing your skill set, your resources, your knowledge and know-how, but also imparting that on some of the people that you employ, the local people, I think would be highly beneficial to kind of equalize that imbalance and redress that kind of you know, disparity between the rich and poor divide, as they often see us as being rich people. So, you know, I think there's a real onus on us to just be more conscious of our responsibility to reciprocate. You know, we're coming to these countries and we're benefiting from the lifestyle, from the, you know, the quality of life being far cheaper, the weather, the fresh food, and all of that good stuff, but not to look at it from a privilege of entitlement or I'm better than or I know more. And actually, I feel like it's especially amongst some of the young people that I've spoken to during my time there, mostly people who have returned or, you know, they got their second generation Ghanaian. And there is more of a social consciousness of, okay, well, I can't just come here and tell them, no, that's not how you do it, you know, and respecting, but also, you know, maybe introducing some of their ways so that it's not just like, you know, I am from the West, I am right, this is how you're supposed to do it. This is, you know, and I think there's an opportunity to amalgamate both, you know, the old and the new. In just what I said in terms of what we've just said in terms of Sankofa, learning from the past, learning from the indigenous, and also bringing in the new from wherever you're coming from. So, yeah, please, please do take that. You know, if you are somebody who's looking to move back or you're just visiting, just in the way that you speak to people, don't, you know, always allow that privilege, because often people will treat you preferentially because, you know, of that proximity to the whiteness. So I think that's something really, really important to take into consideration.
Yeah.
Definitely. But yeah, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, and I think I mean, one thing that's been quite interesting, so when you left and just before I left, so I've only been back a week, there was a sudden 20% increase in the exchange rate. Not in Ghana's favour.
Oh.
So prices literally just went up. And it was bound to happen because I think in the UK, we saw prices have been slowly going up over the last maybe 8 months or so. I remember my sister sending me a message while I was in Ghana to say that a bottle of olive oil in Aldi or somewhere had gone from £2 something to £6 something.
That was me.
Oh, was that you?
That was me. I was like, what?
Exactly. What? So you guys had that. We're just starting to experience that in Ghana.
Right.
And so it's kind of like it's crazy, that whole thing. And that happens often for us. When you move back to Ghana, that actually happens probably about once every year and a half. You get these huge spikes. But what happens is if you're still able to earn pounds or dollars,
yes,
you have this window of time where your money is suddenly now worth more cedis, but what you're buying is still the same price.
Yes.
Yeah, like I found with kente strips, I've been buying strips, single strips of kente for nearly 30 years, and it's always £5 in English money. Every time I'm in Ghana, it's a different Ghanaian figure, but it's always between £3.50 and £5. So that's one of the ways in which it's unfair to Africa, because if you live there and you've got no access to the money that's stable, it's like what you said to me about the oil. It went up more than double.
Exponentially.
Totally. And you didn't have another control money that was worth more, so you just had to spend more of your money. And that's how it is for Ghanaians all the time. But you always have that advantage if you move to Ghana and you've got access to foreign currency. So in a way, when you do move to Ghana, in some ways it's good to keep some kind of stream of income that's coming in from the West, because you've got that control money. And it's one of the advantages, unfortunately, in how our banking is set up. So I think that's one of the that's one of the kind of main things. I mean, I know some things happened with you and some things have happened with me where you also see the differences in coming from Europe or coming from the Caribbean and returning to Ghana, and seeing that actually there are certain feelings that people over there do not have education about history, and so there's just some things that they don't understand. So maybe you can talk about going to the castles, going to the slave castles.
So you know, when you go back, depending on, you know, why you're going back, but there's often, you know, whether it's tourism, you know, you're more than likely end up at the coast to visit one of the castles, you know, namely Elmina Castle. I forget the name of the other one.
Yeah, Cape Coast Castle.
Yeah. So, you know, the two slave castles that were housing the slaves before they were shipped off through the door of no return. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as an African Caribbean, you know, coming back and visiting for the first time the castle, you know, I remember going there earlier this year, and we were in a group, and one of my friends, you know, he was quite upset and you know, was arguing with the guys at the entrance about the pricing. So the pricing, as many of us know, when we go back to like the Caribbean or somewhere, there's always a local price for local people, and then there's a price for you know, other, yeah, you know, foreigners. And in this case, that was what it was. So there's a price for the Ghanaians, non-Ghanaians. And, you know, it was like you're coming back to this place where your people were enslaved and shipped off, which is a highly, deeply ancestrally traumatic. Even if you're not conscious of it, you will feel something. Mm-hmm. You will feel something when you're in there. And, you know, he was arguing about the price of, you know, it wasn't so much about the money, and I totally understood it from his perspective. It was the principle of, we pay the same price as any other person that comes here, that visits, whether they're European and white, whether they're Jewish, whether they're Asian. And it's actually, this place wouldn't exist but for our people being sold into slavery. And so there's this dichotomy between the, I guess, the commercial aspect of tourism, and obviously, yeah, it's there to you can't be free for everyone. And I'm not saying that it needs to be the same price for us as, you know, African Caribbeans or African diasporans to, you know, in comparison to the Ghanaian price. No, I think that the Ghanaians should have their price as locals, absolutely. There should then be a second tier, maybe it'd be for other Africans. You know, why can't you have 3, 4, 5 tiers? In fact, I've seen that in, I think it was in Uganda. I went to a conservation centre and they had like, you know, Ugandan price, and they had like ECOWAS, I believe it was, price, and they had another price and another price. So it was a different tiers. And I'm thinking, you know, I would implore the government or the Minister of Tourism or whoever to consider something like that, especially because it's so embedded in our psyche, in our spirit, in our DNA, the atrocities that happen to our people, that it almost seems like a slap in the face, an abomination of some kind, that we have to pay the same price based purely on principle. And as an African Caribbean, I definitely felt, I hadn't thought about it at the time when I was, you know, when I was in the entrance, but as soon as my friend brought the subject up and he was arguing with the people, like, he was like, they were calling him, oh, don't, you know, brother, that's just the price. And he was like, don't call me brother. Do you know what I mean? Because it was like, it's unfair. It's unjust. And so, yeah, I'm really thinking, Akwia, about writing a letter, an open letter, on a direct letter to the government, because unfortunately there isn't enough education on both sides, insofar as the local Ghanaians not knowing about slavery. They could be outside selling their wares and crafts and whatnot as you're going in.
Yeah.
And it's like you're bombarded as you go in.
And there's no empathy.
And then there's no empathy. There's no nothing.
No.
You're kind of almost mentally, I mean, I know I was mentally and spiritually, I did a little prayer before I went in to prepare myself of whatever it is that I might feel, especially as an empath. And when I was in there, I mean, I was also filming, but I really did, at one point I felt sick. I actually felt sick and a bit dizzy. And that was just me kind of partially being involved. I was kind of like, you know, as I said, I was filming, so I was kind of more documenting. But, you know, once I stopped, I was feeling something. So there's no regard and sensitivity around the fact that this has happened to these people that are returning. This happened to their people and or our people. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like these are our cousins, our distant relatives.
100%.
And I just feel like there needs to be more of a regard for that. Consciously, a conscious effort, by the government, by the tourism board, by whoever. So yeah, that's what I'll be doing.
Yeah, I think it's a really good. I think it's a really good idea because, and I think I've only come to that. I haven't started off on that point, so I should say that because I watched the footage of the gentleman going off, and it was interesting to watch because at first I was watching it and just seeing it very dispassionately and seeing what he didn't see. So because when he was arguing, he kept on saying, "I'm not European." And in that moment, I was completely transported to being almost like a Ghanaian guard, thinking, but it doesn't say it's a price for Europeans. It says Ghanaians and non-Ghanaians. And it was only after watching it so many times, I saw where he was speaking from his emotion. It was this thing of, at this moment, I need to be acknowledged as the status that I am. And I thought later after we spoke, and I thought it's really interesting because when you go back to Africa, on the surface, you've got that, you know, you can exhale.
Yeah,
you can release because actually that other sensibility that you have when you live here, which is that second set of eyes that's always on guard, is relaxed. You're not any longer on guard. And so, it can feel like the old feelings from the West are all gone, but they're still there. They haven't been processed and things can happen. And suddenly that pain, and I realized that's what happened to him in that moment of seeing that sign. He did not see what was written. All he saw was himself not included. And so that's why he kept on saying, "I am not European." And it was, I thought the guys were really well trained because when I first watched it, I would be there going, "There isn't a European price." Like I would be arguing with him going, "I don't know what's wrong with you. If you won't pay the money, leave." Because it's like the money, we should let people know, was £5 for non-Ghanaians. And I think it worked as £1.10 for Ghanaians. And so essentially somebody who earns a lot more than most ordinary British people was arguing over £3.90. But he wasn't arguing over £3.90.
That's right. Yeah.
But also for the Ghanaians, the money is for the upkeep of these places that are visited by non-Ghanaians. So you had all these different worlds in one moment. But I do admire the guys who dealt with him because I think in that moment, I wouldn't be like them. I would just be like, "See you then if you don't want to pay." And I wouldn't have that empathy.
Yeah.
Even though I've been in his position before where that rage of the injustice of where we find ourselves has come out before, but I didn't recognize that was what was happening with him.
So what happened in your case?
So what happened in my case was first time back in Ghana as an adult, 24 or 25, and there'd been a whole thing. KLM had lost us, so ended up in Ghana 3 days later. So there was no one to meet me. My first time back in Ghana since I was 9 years old.
No mobile phones.
No mobile phones in those days. So I'd had to go and stay with somebody who was actually just on the flight. So I stayed with them, phoned home to England, found out that my uncle, who had come to meet me originally, was coming back to the airport. So me and my friend go to the airport to try and meet him in arrivals. They let my white friend through and then stop me and won't let me through. And that's where this rage, which I was completely not conscious of.
Was it obvious that it was because she was white or was it?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Because we're walking just together.
Just allowing for that discernment and that.
Totally. Like literally, we are walking together. He walks past the guard who smiles at him and then turns to me and stops me. and says, "You're not traveling. Show me your passport." So I tried to use my advantage in that point. And I spoke to him best English accent. Mm-hmm. No, that was it. I started speaking to him in Tri,
right?
Thinking I'm Ghanaian. Mm. I start speaking to him in Tri. Mm. He answers me back in Tri, like, "No, you're not going through." And then that's when the anger came from a place I didn't even know I was going to get angry. Mm. It was just bang, mm-hmm. all of a sudden. And then when I got angry, I went to the easiest language for me, which is English. Nice. So then I'm screaming at him in English and effing and blinding. And also just what I was saying, you know, was kind of similar to what this other guy was saying, was just sort of talking about, I was saying to him, "This cannot happen in my country. This is my country. I am Ghanaian." Mm-hmm. And there was tears and everything. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing because a guy who'd come off the plane, a Ghanaian German guy, just came, dropped his baggage and just hugged me. Mm. And I was just crying into this guy's shoulder. And then you're embarrassed because mm-hmm. it's like, oh, damn.
Yeah.
I'm crying.
So then from that perspective, with that rage and that anger, comparatively, you know, with somebody who's going into a place of...
Absolutely.
You know, historic atrocity, like the worst ever situation.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you likened it to, you know... the feeling of losing a child, like you've lost a child, you can't find them, or they've been kidnapped, or you know, and you don't know when you're going to see them again.
Totally,
you know,
totally.
And that being something that, you know, in that moment he had that.
Yeah,
and it sounds like he didn't even explode as much as you did.
No, I don't. I mean, you know, being a man, he wasn't allowed to cry, innit? But you know, you could, when you watch it, you can feel that.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought the workers were good, because they met him with compassion. Whereas when I was watching it, I'd forgotten my own explosion.
Right.
And I was just watching it like, bloody leave then, if you don't want to pay the money. Yeah. You know,
also to think that that's in, like I said, that's in our DNA.
Yeah, 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 totally.
As African Caribbeans, it's embedded. It's
absolutely.
You may not even be aware of it. And maybe he's been there before.
It was like something happened. And I think that's the thing of complex PTSD, because that's what that was a thing of. Mm-hmm. It's why, you know, even, and I really hate this term, but even the idea of the angry black woman, all of these things, they are all moments of complex PTSD. There is something, there's a trauma and it gets triggered and you don't know how it's going to,
or when.
And I think it becomes safe for you to do it in Africa. Because no one's going to shoot you. You know, you're not going to get hauled off to a mental hospital. So I think actually it's easier for us to get in touch with that extreme injustice in a safe place, which Africa becomes for us. But yeah, there is a lack of education. I mean, there wasn't with those guys who dealt with the guy we're talking about. They really dealt with him well, so they're educated because they must have seen that so many times.
So and he ended up paying the local price.
And that they let him do that, which, as someone who sells stuff, like, you know, I would have been, give me my 80 CDs type of thing. But I thought they dealt with it really, really well, because it isn't talked about. And then from the African point of view, I was saying to you the other day, there's literally no discussion of what Africa lost in the transatlantic slave trade. And even when the discussion comes up and people say, yeah, but Africans sold Africans, I think it's again another ignorance, because it's not like somebody knocked on the door going, "Hi, do you know what? I'd like to buy some black people." And then the person turned around and says, "Uncle Fester, Auntie Doris, see you later." And they took the money. You know, this was not, and neither was it that when white people arrived, there was cages full of black people who were sold to them. So it's not of an equal footing at all, at all, at all, at all. And actually, there's very little exploration historically of how this trade came about. You'll have people saying, oh yeah, but there was a trade in slaves in Africa before the white people came. What did that look like? If it's true, what did that look like? It's certainly there was no castles, there was no dungeons, there was no people tied up waiting to be put on boats. So what really happened on the continent, it's still the most unexplored part of this story. And about 12 years ago, I was here with some filmmakers and we were going to do a short film to try and raise money for a bigger film looking at the story from within Africa. And I can tell you, just even on the research stage, all these history books were not making sense. None of them were making sense. You got some books that say that you have 30,000 Arab kind of slave traders storming through Ghana, taking slaves. There's no evidence. And then you get another book that says that slaves were captured in threes, fours and fives. And then you've got different parts in Ghana where they'll say these were points where slaves stopped to get water. When you've gone to any of them and you look at the route, it's like, where were these people walking? Mm. Who were the guards? Mm. Because you cannot, even today, even with cars, and we're talking about people being on foot, they weren't even on horses.
Yeah, for how many days, months, weeks?
And nobody tried to fight these people? Mm. Knowing Africans today as we know them, we're not even talking about the past, we're talking about how a community works now. Do we really believe that it was possible for 3-4 people or 30,000 people with guns to take Africans from the north of Ghana down to the south freely, with nothing happening, through what jungles, what roads? So there's a lot of the Africa side completely unexplored. That's the work for future people to do. But there's a lot of stuff untapped, I think, inside the African body and the diaspora body, and they come out in these spaces. Half of it is the explosion and the other half is the dampening. So I think the reason why, if you go to where the slave castles are, the people who live there, it's like they don't see where they are. They're completely unengaged with the story.
Completely.
Which is another trauma response. It's like, it's weird, isn't it? How did you experience just being around those places and the local people and their disinterest?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you... it's interesting that you identify or, you know, kind of see it as a trauma response. And it could well be that.
Mm.
But for me, I think it's back to what we're saying, just a lack of knowledge, just an ignorance, because it's just a castle. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's what it is. And, you know, even last night when I was speaking to someone who's also sort of, you know, Caribbean, who's returned to, you know, she's got a house in Ghana, back and forth for many, many years. And when she finally decided to go to Elmina Castle, she was saying that, you know, her trauma response was that there were like school kids there on a trip and they were all just jolly. I mean, they're kids are going to be kids. But, you know, there was no sensitivity around it and there's no one trying to kind of like, you know, control the kind of, you know, like we're in this environment, like, you know, behave accordingly type of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like an outing. It's just a day out. It could be going to Thorpe Park or Chessington. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's the same kind of energy. So for me, I think it's a shame. And I think that's one way that colonization has kept us separate, you know, mentally. You know, we are essentially family. We are lost relatives returning.
Yeah.
And instead of it being like, oh, so sorry, like there should be a thing when you come in, not like a singing and dance. I'm not saying that, and I'm not saying, you know, it has to be anything big, but like a some sort of plaque or something. There is a plaque. It says something about, you know, in honor of and memory of our ancestors. But I'm talking from the perspective, and I know that we're going to get onto this, of a public apology. Mm. You know, we've seen so much about a public apology across, you know, different churches in the UK for their part in the transatlantic slavery. And I know that you've shown me some evidence that there has been that had taken place in Ghana. But unfortunately, no, I'm in my early 40s. I've never come across it. Mm. I happened to ask a few people just on the back of our preparation for the show.
Yeah.
And, you know, that, you know, well versed, one of them has actually written a history book, a black history book. And she's like, no, I don't, it's not that, you know, I'm not aware of that.
Yeah,
I'm not aware of that I've ever heard. It's not in my psyche. She's like, I don't think I've ever heard of it. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So unless you actually go looking for it. And my thing is, why should we have to go looking for the apology? Like, when, you know, it's something that should be embedded in the culture. It should be a part of the tapestry, so that you know that we've had this discourse where there is some sort of compassion and empathy insofar as an apology. Yes, we're given land. Yes, I know that there are various ceremonies and things, but how is it that we know about, you know, the Holocaust and the reparations that they've received? You know, that's common knowledge throughout the world, you know, or at least to us. Like, I'm black. I've got nothing to do with what happened with them. That's not connected to my identity.
Yeah.
But yet still, I know the story, and I know that the Germans have apologized, and they've given them money and everything else, you know. So, yeah, definitely more needs to be done.
I mean, it brings us back to also who's in charge of the media, and then what things are funded. So we have Black History Month, and it's quite interesting who pays for a lot of Black History Month projects and stories. And once again, it's also which end of the story of slavery helps the agenda of whoever is ruling our planet at this stage. And so if you look at, okay, where does the money go in our story? Well, the money goes constantly to showing the pain on the black body.
Yes.
That's where the money goes. That's why, you know, they make sure that every 12 to 15 years, because that's a generation, you've got another 12 years a slave, you've got roots, you've got all those things. And then as we're talking, I've seen one film in my lifetime in my late teens, early 20s, that was set around the castles of Ghana. One film. And it was only one part of the film that was there. I haven't seen one film that talks about the interior. So even that journey, all the story of slavery seems to just start from the door of no return. So, and I don't know who pays for that research, because all of those kind of things. I mean, when we tried to do our research, because we wanted to do a documentary following from the north to the south. And so we were using all these old books. And then we started talking about who we're going to try to fund this. There wasn't Netflix then. It's the sort of thing I can imagine Netflix today, you probably could get money for. But minus Netflix, if we look at all the other media things, it'd be hard to get the money unless you had a famous black person doing the journey for the BBC or Channel 4 type of thing. So,
and it's not in the interest, is it? It's not in the interest of
It's our interest. So we have to, I mean, you know, now we have the internet, now everybody's got a camera. We have to tell the stories that are important to us, and then we have to lobby the people for the things that are important to us. So I think it's cool for you to do your letter.
My letter, yeah.
Yeah, because everybody's doing what's important to them. So it's like you identify a need, and then you have to try and make it happen if it's that important to you.
Absolutely it is. And just from my 1-2 conversation on WhatsApp last night, it's obviously something that maybe people haven't really thought about, but they will at some point experience.
Yeah.
When they go back, whether it's, you know, Ghana or wherever else. Mm. And Ghana's obviously the focus on there because that's where we've been.
Mm.
And that's where all the kind of crazes now with regards to people going back and returning, whether it's Dirty December, which is phenomenal, you know, campaign, whether it's the Year of Return. But what do you think? In what other ways then could we kind of, or not we, I mean, maybe the Ghanaian government welcome, or what more could they be doing to kind of just, not appease, that's not the word I'm looking for, but just to kind of make us feel welcome in a way that's like we've been recognised, we've been acknowledged.
Of the history.
Of the history
end of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting one. So for me as a Ghanaian, I feel like the fact that diaspora people can get free land is a recognition.
Mm-hmm.
If you go especially to the coastal parts, they do have ceremonies of welcoming people back, symbolically coming back through the door of no return.
Right.
There's ceremonies if you go to the last river point that they say is the last place they used to wash the slaves before they brought them to the castles. I went there. Historically, I feel like that's made up, but that's just me. Like, I just feel like, but it's a nice thing anyway.
Okay.
And you can get given your Ghana name. So there are these things there, but the people who've chosen to do those things, they don't have loads of money to now start massive campaigns to let people know. So you kind of find out if you start on that journey and you start looking at tours, and that all of those things are actually there. There is a stool for returnees called the Fiancra stool.
Okay.
There's and that was created by Samarkand kings that came together and queens, and they created the Fiancra stool. And I think it's had two people sit on it so far in terms of being like the diaspora king and queen, so that they could have representation. What I heard about the Fiancra stool was it started to become quite powerful. And the story was that the CIA sent people, they infiltrated the movement. Suddenly there was a lot of dissension. So the stool's still there. But as far as I'm aware, there is no head on it at the moment. Nobody's sitting on it.
Never even heard of it.
It's one of those things. And there's been other movements where diasporan people, there's a Ghana Association of Caribbean People, there's one of Americans, and they do come together to do things, and when they do, they're a really big force. But one thing that I think plagues our communities outside of Ghana, I won't say the whole of Africa because every culture is different, I would say one of the unique things about Ghana, why we've never had a civil war, is the way in which the system of chiefs and queens talking about a problem. You get to a stage like, so let's say I take, at the moment we've got a problem in our family with one of my cousins. If we take that to a king and queen and they sit down to talk about it, there gets to a stage where whoever they have decided is in the wrong, you should apologize and you should stop doing what you're supposed to be doing. If you don't, you get shunned by everyone. Like if you're like, I am so hurt that I will never accept your apology, you get shunned by everyone. Because at some stage, to move forward, somebody has to let go. And I think that's one of the things that maybe is historical because of the backgrounds people have gone through from the Caribbean and the Americas and being in Europe. One of the things that happens is when things end up in front of the chiefs, we don't have that history thing of let it go. And unfortunately, that's what's broken our movements when we've come together on the continent, definitely in Ghana, when the Caribbean associations, the African American associations, they will not let things go. They cannot think about the bigger, longer vision of what they want.
Right.
They get so far, there's a problem, and the whole thing explodes. And I think it's because they don't have that culture of understand and listen to the elder. The elder says, let it go, because you will have another time. Mm. Think of the bigger picture. Plan for seven generations. Mm. That used to be a saying that was really embedded in a Akan culture. You know, it's not just today. You might lose today, but you can win tomorrow. Mm. So unfortunately, those associations have been broken up, but yeah, they've still made inroads. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got, it's easier now for African Americans and Caribbeans to get Ghanaian passports. Yes. It's easier now to get a stay and citizenship. Mm-hmm. All of those things have been won, mm-hmm, by groups of people coming together. So I hope that the Fiankaran stool can be, you know, someone can sit on it again and, yeah, make that come back in, because I think that's probably one of the most positive things that happened, was to, you know, here, yeah, is a stall, it comes with land, yeah, it comes with all this responsibility.
Yeah.
And
I definitely feel that Fianca stall, I'm going to look more into that, but I really do feel that, you know, those, all of those incentives, measures, you know, whatever you want to call them, are fantastic. And it, and I can definitely see, you know, the ease of repatriation into Ghana from the Americas, from wherever, it's like I said, but there's less red tape, you know, to open a business, to buy land. Although there's obviously issues and disputes within land acquisition, as we know, that's a whole different topic, totally, but that's for everyone. And, but I feel like an apology is exclusively, you know, something that is, it's intangible. Mm. It's speaking to, you know, the pain and the trauma of what it is that you've experienced, or what it is that you may still experience as a diasporan. Mm. That's embedded in the history and the culture of both sides. So I feel like it's still something that definitely needs to happen alongside those incentives, you know, because I can say, I bought you this, you know, but I stole your phone or something, but I just, you know, there you go.
Yeah.
But then I'm not bothered to actually acknowledge and apologize for it. So you're still going to feel hurt because you've not even heard the words, that you've not received the acknowledgement. And I think you're right. There's also this thing of, once that does take place, being able to let it go. Mm. And it's funny that you mentioned about the bigger picture and that being a traditional sort of a Akan ideology or philosophy, because my experience of kind of like traveling across Africa over the past year is that a lot of the, maybe this is more so for the poorer people, but they're literally just kind of living for today. Mm. You know, you'll say, they'll just be thinking about when they're asking for money or whatever, it's just about now. It's just about today.
Yeah.
They're not thinking about next week or, well, you do this job for me, I'm going to pay you a little bit of money just to see how you're doing. Oh, no, but I need this. Or do you mean they'll be arguing for this little, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's still a little money.
Yeah.
But not thinking about the relationship that they're building, not thinking about the future.
Yeah.
Not thinking about, I mean, there was one guy that I was working with, and he alluded to the fact that he wasn't getting much money from the work that we were doing. He was being paid by somebody else, but that he was looking at the bigger picture, the longevity of building the relationship, which I was like, okay, cool. He was like, you know, I think 30, 31 years old. So I thought, that's great. So I don't know if it's just maybe a class thing, because he was quite educated. You know, he'd worked for a big multinational company before, and you know, all that kind of thing. So his mindset was possibly different from the local person in the, you know, in the village.
Yeah,
that's
just trying
to eat today and feed their family.
And I think it's a real city thing, and it's another one of those things where there's a clash of worlds once again. Mm. Because I remember telling you about, I got a thing saying a lady was coming in from the Caribbean who was looking to stay in Ghana. And so I wrote a proposal based on a conversation that I had with her and her friend over the phone, how much I was going to charge her, what services I could give her, what introductions I could do. And it was really interesting, because on the phone, when the three of us were together, it was so friendly. It was so like, we're all going to be mates.
And then money's involved.
Yeah. And so I sent, and I made sure, you know, there was no misunderstanding. Straight after the conversation, I sent how much I was going to charge. And then I wrote a document that in the first paragraph said how much I was going to charge. And then when I heard from the person 3 days later, the tone was very different. Mm. The tone was like I was working for her. Mm. She wanted information. I helped her straight away because I'm like, that's cool. You know, she's in a fix. Mm. And then she wanted information again. And when I was like, let me know how much everything else you want so I can charge you. Mm-hmm. I never heard from her again. Mm. And the rudeness of that whole interaction.
An entitlement. Like an we were entitlement talking about before.
Of the, you've never met me a day in your life. Mm. You've literally met me on the phone and you're expecting me to give you my 30 years of expertise for nothing. For why? Mm-hmm. And
for why?
For why? And it was, yeah, one of those moments.
Audacity.
Yeah. And I, and you know, she worked in banking and I would love to, if I sat down with her, I would love to ask her, if you were in Dubai, would you have expected to have somebody in Dubai giving you all this prized information for free?
For nothing, yeah.
You know? So, I mean, there's lots and lots and lots of these moments where these worlds kind of clash and collide. But I think definitely for us and for Ghana and for anybody going back, there is so much more to be done because there's so much stuff unexplored. And as I say, I've seen nothing that talks about what did Africa lose. If it's true that 10 million black bodies went through the slave castles of Ghana, what did we lose? Because they weren't taking the people with the broken legs and the arm that didn't work. You know, and that discussion has never been had. You know, the stories my mum's generation was told was, oh, it was all the bad people got sent away to be slaves, so you don't have to worry about it. Well,
oh wow,
yeah, that's what they were told.
The unruly Jamaicans, yeah.
Yeah, that's literally, that's what my mum's generation were told at school.
Wow.
They were told those things. So there's so many things to be addressed.
Absolutely.
Yeah, in that.
There's so much work to be done on both sides. I mean, I think there's a lack of compassion and empathy. But it's all a part of the unprocessed healing.
Absolutely. And so based on money and where Africa is positioned. Because when you talk about slavery and stuff to Ghanaians, they're literally looking at you like, but you earn 20 times what I do because your ancestor got taken to America.
Yeah. So therefore you're over there. So you're actually, in the end, you were better off.
Yeah. Like literally you're saying stuff. Mm. I took me and Nana, my sister, we took our niece. We always say that was the biggest waste of money we ever did. We took her to the castles and we did the tour. And the only thing she found valuable was the site where the first black African priest was buried next to white people for the first time. That's the only thing she kept on talking about. Oh, that was so good. They buried the Ghanaian priest in the same place they buried the white priest.
Wow.
That's the only thing she took from the whole journey. Hearing all of the stuff,
yeah,
it was all
disconnect.
But they're in America, but they're in the UK, that's all. But that also points to the level of poverty people feel. It's, I don't know, it's a bit like Beckham and Victoria coming to us to moan, I'm only rich now because my ancestor was taken to football and pop star land. It's like, yeah, but look what you have.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a hard place.
It is for both sides. But yeah, so these are some considerations, you know, when you're going to Ghana, especially if, you know, when visiting the castles. Process your pain. And on that note, just to wrap up, I believe you've got some resources, Akwea, to share with some people in case you are somebody who likes to do your research, to read, and some things that will help.
Yeah, so I mean, first and foremost, I think probably if you're in the UK and you're looking to learn more about racism so that you don't repeat stuff by being in the position of power, then I would say Robin DiAngelo's books, White Fragility, mm-hmm. and then she's got a new one, I think it's called Nice Racism. They're both good books to read. And if you read and understand them as the person who could be in the place of whiteness, mm-hmm. you're going to have a really, really good time. Mm-hmm. And then I would say if you look at there's a whole movement around I think it's called nigritude, mm-hmm. and it's really the process of what you go through as you become fully aligned and yourself as a person in a black body, mm-hmm. so the different stages, the anger stage which we talked about, right. And all of those things. So you can look into nigritude,
yes.
and you can read Frantz Fanon, mm-hmm. I think it's Black Masks, White Faces.
White Face, yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a brilliant book as well that explains the interior. And then one of the things that I'm organising next year in January is a plant medicine retreat in Ghana, where we're actually also, we've got lots of things inbuilt to really bring up and let go of the internalized trauma, the internalized racism as well that we have, the stuff that we have as black parents, as black women, as black men. We've got people who are going to be there to help with movement, to help with different plant medicines, and lots of traditional ceremonies, how to wash your soul, how to take care of your soul once a week and really acknowledge that place in you that doesn't belong to anybody else,
wow.
and the things that you can do for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's
powerful.
Going to be 10 days.
Wow.
And we have a whole host of Ghanaian healers who are going to be there, plants people, herbalists, to take you through that journey. We're going to visit some amazing water bodies for some amazing cleansings and movement places. And we're staying in beautiful places, really, yes. really beautiful places.
So how can they find out a bit more about that?
So the best way is to contact me through Instagram, mm-hmm. or Facebook. My name is Akwia Ofosuhene. It'll be in the show notes as well, mm-hmm. all my contact details.
Yes.
And yeah, we can take it from there. And it's
yes.
going to be called African Spiritual Practices Retreat.
Beautiful, powerful, necessary, owning it. That's how we can be owning it for real. So yeah, definitely be sharing those notes. But until then, I hope you've enjoyed the show. And if you've got any contributions, comments or questions or feedback, please do so on my page at Owning It With Iola on Instagram. And also you can also give your feedback on Colourful as well, and wherever you see it online. So stay tuned.
Remember, we don't stop until the music stops, and the music never stops on Colourful Radio.
Remember that.